Please, O Lord our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel.
Shabbat shalom, everyone. Hey, wasn't that fun with Mark Kinzer last week? And all those young people here? Oh, it's so terrific. But, you know, that's the way life is. You have it punctuated with these phenomenal moments, and the rest of the time you just continue living and worshiping and doing, and not everything can be quite have the same level of excitement and profundity. Today, I want to talk with you about a very important dimension that we experience in our tradition and in the Scripture. It has to do with God revealing himself through the normal life cycle. And I want to focus on one particular aspect, and that is something we don't talk a lot about, but it's the institution of marriage. I'd like to begin by sharing the words of a 1965 song Frank Sinatra made famous, Love and Marriage, Love and Marriage. They go together like a horse and carriage. This I tell you, brother, you can't have one without the other. Love and marriage, love and marriage. It's an institute you can't disparage. Ask the local gentry, and they will say it's elementary. Does that song sound trite and passé to you? It kind of does. Now, of course, if you're a younger person, you may not have ever heard that in your life. Just out of curiosity, how many of you have never heard that song in your life before? Well, we got a few, right? But most of you have. And now, the song, right? The song may have a kind of idealistic, trite quality to it, to some of our modern ears, but let me tell you something. It's amazing how some of those songs capture something that is profoundly important, not just for individual happiness, but for society in general. Love and marriage, and a lot of people nowadays, half the population having, you know, but anyhow, let me talk to you about love and marriage, and I'd like to use Chaye Sarah as kind of a starting place. Now, you know that Sarah, and Rabbi Nathan mentioned this in his introduction to the passage, that she lived 127 years, quite an elderly lady when she passed away. But Chaye Sarah, interestingly enough, which is about the life of Sarah, that's what the title Chaye Sarah means, the name of the parsha. But actually, it only focuses, again, as he mentioned, on her passing. And in rabbinic understanding, the last 2 years of her life. She lived to be 127 years old, and she died in Kiryat Abba, that is in Hebron. Hebron, it's on the West Bank, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham went to mourn for his wife and to weep over her. And again, the paradox. And there's a lot of paradoxes that we'll be alluding to here. But the name of the parsha, Life of Sarah, but it's about her death. Now, I want to share with you a midrash about this point in her life when she dies, and rabbis noticed, and darshanim, preachers from a long time ago, noticed that Genesis 22 is about the Akedah, and right after that, we learn about the death of Sarah. The Midrash goes like this. Abraham came to mourn Sarah, the death of his wife. He came directly from Mount Moriah, where he had offered Isaac as a sacrifice. And the Midrash says that Satan appeared as soon as the angel of the Lord had stayed Abraham's hand from killing Isaac, because Satan wanted Isaac dead. That Isaac then, out of frustration and coming up with a next best strategy, appears as Isaac to his mother. And she says, where were you? And then the deceiver says, well, I was with Dad. He led me to the top of a mountain, built an altar, tied me on top of it, and was going to try and kill me. And at that point, it says that Sarah expired out of just sheer grief, out of the possibility that her husband would have done such a thing. And actually, there are other similar midrashim, which says that Satan created a flood that almost drowned Abraham on his way to the top of Mount Moriah. One thing we learn from this is that the idea of Satan, that is, this figure who is opposed to God, as a real person, although modern Judaism is embarrassed by the concept, older generations of Jews were not embarrassed by it at all. They understood that this was a reality, and we do too, of course. That's one thing, but what we see here is the forces of darkness having a plan for Abraham's marriage, and that is to destroy it, to kill Sarah. Now keep in mind, a midrash is not the same as scripture. It's a homiletical or a sermon-type reflection that seeks to answer questions about the text that the text doesn't necessarily address. And so that's the nature of midrashim. They're not necessarily to be taken at face value, but still they reveal things. They kind of tease out meanings that we might have missed. So we have this concept then of the evil one hates marriage. He wants to destroy them. He really does. That's his purpose. Satan has a plan for your marriage and mine too. Now, as the Parsha goes on, and if you've read it this week, we only read one little section of the Parsha, but I want to encourage you all to read the whole thing before Shabbat. And if you have, you'll recall that the majority of the portion is about Abraham buying a cave, the cave of Machpelah, to bury his wife who had just passed away. So you have this very interesting dialogue between the leader of the Hittites and Abraham about how he can purchase this piece of property. And clearly one of the reasons that this is included in the Torah is to show that Abraham, in partial fulfillment of God's promises to give the land to him, buys his first piece of property in the land. So the cave of Machpelah is the first fruits. It's the first bit of property that Abraham actually owns in the land. But I want to suggest also that great love for Sarah underlies this. He had been married to her for a long, long time. And I like to think that when he bought this cave and paid a fair amount of money for it and wouldn't allow the local inhabitants of the land to give it to him for free, that a lot of that was motivated by love for her. And you know, you wonder, did he look back at his life with his wife and have regrets? Did he look back and say, you know, as he's there alone in the tent for the first time, he's by himself, there's no Sarah anymore to cook for him or to be there with him and to keep him company. And did he say, you know, I really fouled up big time when I lied to Pharaoh and said that she was just my sister. Boy, I wish I could take that back. I just wonder. It doesn't say anything explicit, but I wonder, did he reflect back on the sad episode where his wife, out of a sense of jealousy for Hagar, said, you've got to get rid of that woman, it's either her or me, and the kid get rid of him too. And did he look back on that with regret? And did he, over all these years, harbor unresolved resentment toward her for making him force his son Ishmael out of their lives? And as he's alone in that tent, did he say, you know, I really held that against her for a long time. I really should have let that go. You know, Abraham we treat as a real person, and we can imagine him having these thoughts. I wonder if he was there, if he'd say to himself, if I can have anything in the world, I got money, I got all the goodies of life, I got all kinds of servants, but if I could have her back for a few hours, I would give it all up. And I wonder if this is how he felt about it. But life continued on through the ups and downs of family life. And then in our parsha, we get to Isaac. And again, we didn't talk about Isaac much today. We talked a little bit. It was a bit oblique. But let me tell you what happened with Isaac. So Abraham now is an old man. And he had been promised a son to carry on. But there's no son around. Ishmael's not around. And he had had Isaac, who he loved so much. And now Isaac's a grown man. But he's unmarried. And so Abraham calls upon his servant, Eliezer, and says, listen, I want you to promise me something. I want you to go back to my family and find a good wife for my son, Isaac. And the story continues that his son goes back to the town where his relatives lived, and he's standing there in the center of the town where the well was for water. And he says to himself, wow, how am I going to find the right girl? And he prays to the God of Abraham and says, God, I tell you what, I want to choose the right person. The woman who comes out and not only gives me a drink, but offers to water my camels. If she then does that, I will know that she is the one who is the one you have chosen. See, I'm standing beside the spring, and the daughters of the townspeople are coming out to draw water. May it be that when I say to a young woman, please let down your jar and may I have a drink, she says, drink, and I'll water your camels too. Let this be the one you have chosen for your servant Isaac. By this I will know that you have shown kindness. It says, before I finished praying in my heart, the servant says, Rebecca, this pretty young girl coming to draw water with her friends, that was the normal job for young women back then, and she approaches this man who's there with his camels, and she goes, excuse me, sir, but you look like you've traveled a long journey. Can I get you some water? You're thirsty? You know, your camels look a little bedraggled. Can I get them water too? And he goes, yeah. And she gives him a drink. And she doesn't water one camel or two or three or four, but sees to it that all of them have water. And I'm sure that these camels drank a lot. And she kept going back to the well and bringing more water. And thereby showing her character, certainly, that she was a kind-hearted person, a hard worker, had a willingness to help people in need. And so, long story short, the servant meets her relatives. He gives them gifts of gold and silver and things. And he says, listen, you know, if you'll have it, I'd love your daughter, Rebecca, to come with me. And I love this line. It says, well, let's ask the girl what she thinks, which in a sense does a number on the stereotype of women having absolutely no say in anything back then. That was a very male-oriented society. I don't want to play that down. But nonetheless, they say, well, what do you want? And Rebecca looks around and says, you know, I'm ready to move on. I'm ready to go to college. I'm ready to get married. And so she says, I'm going to go. And she sits on top of a camel, and they take off. And then I'd like to read this very touching section for you. Now, Isaac had come to Be'er Lahai Roi, for he was living in the Negev, in the southern part of Israel. And he went out to a field on one evening to meditate. And as he looked up, he saw camels approaching. Rebekah also looked up and saw Isaac as she was sitting on the animal. And she got down from her camel and asked the servant, who is that man in the field coming to meet us? He is my master, the servant answered. So she took her veil and covered herself. And then the servant told Isaac all he had done. Isaac brought her into his tent, the tent of his mother Sarah. I think that's very telling. Very brings things all together. And he married Rebekah, and so she became his wife, and he loved her, and Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. And so we have this very beautiful romantic picture. Doesn't perhaps fit the contours of romance in modern America, but nonetheless, here you have this beautiful love story of Isaac grieving the loss of his mother, finding a wife and bringing her into his mother's tent, which I think just completes the circle of his own grieving, and he loved her. And we have again, in this picture of the patriarchs, love, and marriage and the continuing the generations. I'd like to just talk a little bit with you about Yeshua also and his birth. It was not our reading this week. Last week it was alluded to, but there's a section in the description of Yeshua's birth in Matthew where it says that her betrothed, that is Joseph, when he found out that his wife-to-be was pregnant, he was a Torah keeper and he didn't want to disgrace her publicly. And so he wanted to end the relationship quietly without unnecessary harm to her. And I think he deserves a lot of credit because you can imagine the jealousy rising within him as he thought he knew this girl. And he thought that she really loved him. And his initial impression is it isn't quite that simple. But yet, he, out of love for her, even initially wants to put her away without shaming her. And then, of course, what happens is he has a prophetic dream. He has a dream that was so compelling, and an angel told him, listen, she is not pregnant the way you might think. This is a God thing. This is done by the Spirit who has done this. And then, of course, he does take her as his wife, and they live together, apparently until his death later on. Now, to sum all this up, what I want to say is that God's purposes are usually fulfilled one generation following another, with love and marriage and children being the clay, if you will, from which the great potter brings about his plan. Of course, with most things in the world, it's not a piece of cake. It's not always easy. It's not Ozzie and Harriet, everything always perfect. It's just not that way. There are times when it can be tough. And one way to think about it is, you know, life is raisins and almonds. It's sweet, but it has its tough things as well. But what I want to exhort us all as we look at this larger picture is to not buy in to the nonsense offered us by the general culture that because this is an imperfect institution, it isn't worth celebrating and protecting and cultivating. And so I want to encourage you, if you are married, to fight to sustain what you have because the reward for doing so is really, really great. I'm sure Abraham and Sarah had their tough moments along the way, but you really want to fight for it. Have a sense of the incredible loss there is when a marriage needs to end. Now, I want to say, of course, that sometimes not all marriages can be sustained. I get that. We all understand that sometimes it's too bad, but it is what it is. But I want to tell you, divorce and the end of a marriage is a horrible thing, and it really, really affects a lot of people, and especially, and I want to underscore this, especially the children's ability to sustain loving relationships for a long time, for a lifetime. It really does a number on that. I've seen it many times. And so we don't want to do that. Now, if you're younger here, I want to encourage you, and you're not married or maybe newly married, I want you to encourage you to learn from people who get it right and who you can observe and say to them, how did you do this? I mean, you guys seem to get along really well. What's the secret? And I think you'll find that there are some things you can learn which make all the difference in the world, but they can be subtle, but you can learn them. Talk to people who may not be married anymore and find out, you know, from them what they have to learn, because also, sometimes through the tough things of life, we learn important lessons that you younger folks really need to learn. Learn the skills and learn the mindset necessary to enjoy life with that special person when he or she comes along. I wanted to say also, if you're divorced, or if you've lost your spouse another way, through death, whatever, you know, your life is not over, nor is the potential for your blessing people and building the kingdom of God. So, you know, God is the God of second chances, and he understands all the complexities and all the things from which there may be regret. But again, looking back, certain inevitabilities, don't see him mad at you. See him smiling on you with his hand on your shoulder saying, I get it, I understand. But walk with me, and let's continue together, continue to be a blessing for other people, especially younger people who you can help so much. So encourage people about the mistakes and the right things that you did too. Okay, from the lives of Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Rebekah, and we didn't even talk about David and Bathsheba, his wife, and that whole episode and how that is redeemed. From the life of Joseph and Miriam, we see the struggles and complexities of this institution that Frank Sinatra sang about. And we also see how God works his magnificent work through imperfect people like all of us, living each day, day in, day out, living with other imperfect people at home. Let's all, either indirectly by our influence or those of us who are married, support this wonderful institution as best we can. Viva Nisuin! Long live marriage. And Shabbat Shalom.
Please, O Lord, our God, let the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord, our God, let the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. In the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel. In the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel. And may your descendants and the descendants of your people, Israel.